Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Live Up to Freedom Radio. I have absolutely no idea why, but we completely got kicked out, which is a strange. So let me go ahead and bring both Claire and Michael back on, and hopefully you can just all stay with us for now. Claire, are you still there?
Yes, I'm back again. Thanks.
Absolutely. Michael, are you with us?
I am.
This was so strange, and I do apologize, but I guess it's just the beauty of live show, right?
Yeah, never works quite like you expected, especially when they throw you a curveball at the last possible second.
I'm going to blame Claire because she was giving too much truth out there.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks a bunch, guys.
Absolutely. I do apologize. Let's go ahead and resume our discussion.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure where it cut off at. Because I literally got a message where it just said that I was, thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. But I was just stating, like, right now with a lot of our enemies across the red-green axis, like, their short-term interests and goals align. But they're, like you said, Claire, that doesn't necessarily mean that their long-term ones do. Like, they each have reasons for wanting to weaken the U.S. and weaken the West, plus their short-term benefits, whether it's on the financial system with kind of the rise of the BRIC, as an alternative to the petrodollar, or some of these projects that are like, you know, building the liquid natural gas plant in Iran, or railway systems for better access to the Middle East that benefits both Iran and China and Russia in the longer term.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting, specifically about this three-way Russia, Turkey, Iran, I guess, summit, few days ago. What's interesting about that is that each of those participants dreams of being an empire builder of his own. Putin, of course, mm-hmm. wants to reestablish the Russian Empire, be a new Peter the Great, or maybe of Vladimir of Rus from back in 1988. Mm-hmm. Erdogan dreams of reviving the Ottoman Empire, maybe with himself as caliph. The Iranian regime, of course, fights jihad to establish a global Islamic state under rule of Sharia, per the Iranian constitution. Now, obviously, there is history between each of these historically, and those objectives, those empire-building objectives, both in the past, historically, and currently in, one would think, future, clash. Of necessity, they clash with one another. Certainly China, for example, Beijing, is warring against the jihadi Uyghurs out in the western province of China called Xinjiang.
Sure.
And, of course, the Uyghurs want to build their own Islamic state in the middle of Central Asia. So they're coming together, you know, at this summit in Tehran just a few days ago, but that's not really indicative of probably where they've been historically or where they're likely to go in any substantive way much going forward either.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I think long-term they definitely each have their own goals, but I do think the short-term is what they're looking at now, that there are a number of things that have come into alignment for each of them, even with China. Even if China's only real thing that they want out of this is access to rare earth minerals and get access to fuel out of the Middle East, it benefits them short-term to be involved. Same with Russia. I also think it is, to a certain extent, too, just to kind of slap the face of the West again. They have an alignment to increase prosperity. But you are correct.
Yeah,
long-term,
yeah.
They do have competing goals.
Even now they do. I mean, for example, you mentioned rightly that China has forged this long-range deal, a 25-year deal, what is it, $450 billion deal, signed a couple of years ago with Iran, that, you know, the deal would be Iran would supply China with much-needed oil, and China would build out its Belt and Road Initiative infrastructure to all the way out to the Persian Gulf. But in the meantime, what's happened? Russia is now selling oil and gas to China out of Siberia, which geographically makes a whole bunch more sense, and undercutting the China-Iran deal. So even right now, things are not completely aligned.
No, I would agree with that. That's interesting, too. So do you think this is more because they're already able to get those resources to China now at a cheaper price, whereas long-term it would be more beneficial for China to have it coming from the Middle East? And because, again, both ways it's a controlled market. But I think they're also anticipating huge disturbances if countries transition off the petrodollar and things start trading in bricks or rubles or whatever else, that there could be a monetary benefits too.
You know, none of these other currencies is remotely convertible on the open market. They may work among the parties concerned with their own little, you know, agreement, but it's not going to work internationally. But as far as China and Russia and energy, you would think maybe that China, as big a country as it is, well, an empire, it's not a country, it's an empire, would have resources of its own, but it doesn't. It really doesn't in oil and gas or even reliable agricultural land. But so far as the oil and the gas, with Siberia just to the north of China, there's already anticipated the building of new pipelines from connecting Siberia to China. I think with the demographic death spiral that Russia's in right now, it cannot pull out of it. There's no way.
No.
China, of course, also is in a demographic death spiral, but it's going to take longer for them to get there. But in the meantime, I think that China essentially will swallow Siberia, at least in a practical sense, de facto sense, not de jure, but de facto sense. Russia has not the ability, demographic, economic, military, or anything else, to hold on to Siberia. China's going to swallow it and its resources.
Now, what do you think the consequences there would be? Would this be like through war or just through gradually?
No, I don't see it as war. They're sort of de facto buddies right now. But in a practical sense, right now China is a rising power. It is economically orders of magnitude more powerful than Russia, militarily more powerful than Russia. In factual, practical terms, China already has far surpassed Russia, and I don't see that turning around.
Yeah, Russia's essentially turned into a third world country with a few first world cities at this point. I mean, if you go outside of Moscow and the other major cities, it isn't it's not like being in the United States or in Europe. It's still like stepping into a time machine. And the demographic, the death spiral there, it has gotten worse, not better, from the 90s to now. So I'd agree that, yeah, China really does. All they have to do is take over economically. If they're the only ones buying the fuel out of Siberia and they're moving all these businesses in and everything else, they'll essentially have control without having to, you know, physically have control.
Yeah. But look at some of the maps I've seen recently out showing the routes for these new oil pipelines envisioned between China and Russia. Some already exist, but more are going to be built. That's the way China is going to move into and, I think, pretty much take over Siberia and its assets, its natural resources.
So how would all this tie in then to Iran? Because it does seem to be one of the central figures in all this. Everyone's dealing with them.
Yeah. So, again, this is an alignment, an axis of the rogues, of the empire builders. And so we'll add the fourth. I mean, China being the fourth. We got Russia, we got Turkey, we got Iran, and China. But talking about Iran, you know, Iran is in economic freefall. The people are in revolt in the streets because of corruption, mismanagement, and they're just up to there with the mullahs. But as we mentioned before, Iran did forge this 25-year cooperative deal with China. And supposedly now recently out of this tripartite meeting that was held in Tehran, Iran has apparently reached a deal with the Russian oil, natural gas giant Gazprom, supposedly a $40 billion deal for mutual cooperative oil and gas projects. But whether that actually plays out, you know, we shall see. I'm not sure that either one of those places, Iran or Russia, will have the wherewithal to follow through on that. We'll see. Iran, of course, also wants to expand military cooperation with Russia, and that would be the drone sales, aircraft parts, and so forth for Russia's war against Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine. But whether Iran can actually produce the hundreds of UAVs, drones, that Russia wants in short order is not so clear. So there's a lot of stuff that's being talked about, a lot of things that were brought up at this tripartite summit, if you will. China was not there, but the other three. But, you know, whether any or much of that, you know, ever plays out and comes to pass, I think waits to be seen. Oh, the let me add one more thing here. One more thing about the conflicts of interest here. I just talked about Iran agreeing to provide drones to Russia for use in Ukraine. Well, Ukraine already has drones from Turkey that it's using to oppose the Russian invasion. So there's another conflict of interest. How does that work?
Correct.
Yeah.
Can I jump in for a second? I'm sorry. I completely forgot due to all the tech issues. I forgot to let our audience know. At some point, we will, if we get to have the time, we will open our phone line to our listeners. And if anybody wants to call in to either join the conversation or listen in via phone, you can dial 515-605-9799. That's 515-605-9799 if you'd like to join the conversation. Make sure to press 1 when you call in so we know you want to join the conversation. And Claire, let me quickly ask you this since we brought in, which by the way, I just realized as long as Iran's name is not involved, apparently I just keep quiet. I am so racist. But then I'm Iranian. Never mind that part.
No, you're an expert on what you're an expert on.
Well, and here
Thank
I thought you,
you
were an Iranophobe now.
I am Iranophobe. Well, we all are. All American Americans are Iranophobe, but that's a topic that we can hint at later if you have time. But regarding this whole thing you just explained, everything you talked about, Claire, we both know, and I think Michael is familiar enough with regime by now to know, that Iran's regime will literally make any promise, empty promise, to get what they want today. And I think this whole promise, this whole deal with Russia is one of those empty promises they have made. But I guess my curiosity or my question is, what has made Iran desperate enough right now to make such an empty promise or even such a promise or agreement with Russia? What there has to be
well,
something.
Well, I think a few things.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think a few things. The four-year presidential term of President Donald Trump here in the United States really put the squeeze on Iran and the Iranian economy through sanctions. And that pressure is now released with the Biden administration, but the effects, the longer-term effects of those sanctions are still with Iran. They did a great deal of damage to the Iranian economy. But combine that, of course, with rampant corruption at the top levels of the Iranian regime, combine that with the Iranian regime's insistence on continuing to fund its Islamic terror proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Houthis in Yemen and so forth. And then just combine all of that with plain old mismanagement and then toss into the mix the China virus pandemic of the last couple of years, which really devastated Iran. And you can see, one more thing, the country is suffering from really severe drought right now. And a lot of that has to do, again, with mismanagement of water aquifers over the years and diversion of river flow and things like that. But point being, a very serious drought. Put all of that together, and the people are in the streets. 80% of the Iranian people, who are about 85, 86 million in total, 80% of them live at or below the Iranian poverty level, not the U.S. level, the Iranian poverty level of $2 a day.
Whoa.
They're in the streets, as one can imagine and expect. So all of this, I think, is the accumulation of all of these negative factors of the last two and more years.
And I just want to add something for just in case if we have either Iranians who are pro-regime or people, American, who are not well-educated on the topic listening. What Claire just said about people, you know, poverty line of Iranian people living $2, this part has nothing to do with sanctions. I want everybody to know that the money that the government of Iran is sucking out of other countries or stealing out of other countries is not being given to people of Iran. This poverty line, one of the reasons that the number of child brides and number of temporary marriages, all of that has been skyrocketing in the last 10, 12 years in Iran, is actually exactly the fact that mullahs and their children and their next 10 generation are taking the money. So I just want to be sure whenever I say we should put more sanctions back on Iran, it doesn't affect the people. It doesn't matter if we sanction Iran regime or not. People have been living horrible circumstances and situations for almost 12 years now. And that's why they're fighting back. You see Iranian people on the street asking for America to put sanctions back on Iran. So just wanted to put this out there for anyone who's going to say, then why are you against Iran deal or why you say we should put sanctions on them?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Annie. But those sanctions by the Trump administration did put something of a crimp in the regime's ability to fund its terror proxies and to fund its weapons of mass destruction programs. Yes, that's plural, nuclear, biological, and chemical, plus the ballistic missile programs to deliver them. It did put something of a crimp in those programs. And for that reason alone, were well worth it. But no, the money did not, any money coming in, it did not go to the people. And were another nuclear deal, a revival of the, actually it's very moribund at the moment, DOA, JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action from July of 2015, were it somehow to be revived, and the windfall of economic largesse would once again flow into the regime's coffers, no, that would not see its way to the people. They're too corrupt for that, and too wedded to jihad, too wedded to the regime's Islamic imperative to spread Sharia, Islamic law, as far abroad as they can.
Yeah, well, this is also a pattern that we've seen with like the Palestinian same thing. All the money that went to Arafat never made it to the people. We've seen the same with donations, otherwise. With their proxies. We do have to take a break real quick, so we're going to hear from one of our sponsors, and we'll be back with you here shortly.
Extract Jevity is an all-natural energy and health drink developed by Brandon House several years ago with a team of experts. Extract Jevity supports a healthy heart, strong immunity, skin, hair, and nails, cognitive health, and cellular health. This all-natural energy drink is loaded with antioxidants. But don't take our word for it. Do your own research to find the benefits of red wine extract, bilberry extract, grapeseed extract, pine bark extract, and vitamin C. Brannon credits Extractivity in part for his abundance of energy and good health. Order your 30-day supply now at mystore.com. Be sure to use the promo code on the screen for a generous discount. Extractivity, your all-natural source for energy and good health. Find it at mystore.com.
Welcome back to Live Up to Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for staying with us until now. Make sure to go to mystore.com. Under health category, you can find Extractivity products by Brannon House. Use the promo code AC21 to get yourself some discounts and also support this radio. I'm sorry, I froze there. I should have breathed. Claire, I just wanted to say, I know I asked you off air while we were on the break, but thank you. We originally asked Claire to give us 20 minutes of her time today, but she has generously agreed to stay with us during this broadcast. So thank you for that, Claire.
Absolutely. No problem at all.
Yeah, thanks. And we apologize for the technical difficulties. It's they changed the system on us and didn't tell us, those jerks.
Uh-oh.
Oh, they like the five truth tellers.
Yeah, exactly. This is all part of their plan. To kind of bring it back, it's Iran's economy under Trump was suffering, and he was able to help prevent some of these operations. Now that Biden's come back into the swing of things, and we're negotiating through through the hallway with Iran again, bringing that back on the table. They know there's no repercussions. They know Biden is a weak leader that will let them get away with whatever they want. So do you think that's part of why they have this more aggressive behavior again?
Well, what I would say is that those talks in Vienna absolutely are dead at the moment. They're not going on, and it doesn't look like they're going to be able to be revived, much as the Biden administration would like to. I guess they thought it would be a feather in their cap, or they could be the un-Trump or something. I don't know. But it doesn't look like they'll be revived, the talks. But I do have to say that I will give credit where credit is due, and that is that the Biden team, Tony Blinken at State, Jake Sullivan at the National Security Council, even the execrable Robert Malley, lead negotiator for the talks, did hold firm on not removing the IRGC, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, from the United States Foreign Terrorist Organizations list, which was one of the Iranian regime's demands. Another point that I do give credit for is that the Iranian regime refuses to lift its spoken commitment to assassinating some of our former top officials, like former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. That also was a point, a sticking point too far for even the Biden administration. And so on things like that, the talks did founder. And one kind of must think the Iranians knew that would happen. In my opinion, they never expected or maybe even wanted, really, to get back into that deal. Worthless as it was, that they really wanted to stick a thumb in our eye by not coming to another agreement.
That's interesting.
But I think my frustration with Biden cabal, well, the long list of frustration with Biden cabal, one of them is, they still managed to, first of all, make us look as weak as we have ever looked. Secondly, prove that Biden is nothing but a puppet. Last but not least, they still managed to get a couple of $1 billion of their assets, unfroze in a couple of countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
that's absolutely
even though
true.
At this point,
and
even
plus, I was going to say, plus they got the Houthis off the foreign terrorist organizations list under Biden. So There were some gains for them, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I think the question is, why is it that even though some of Biden's advisors even walked, not advisors, negotiators even walked away, I guess my question is, how low are we going to go before American people are going to start paying attention? And again, this isn't about, oh, I'm talking about it, Claire's talking about it, everybody should pay attention. No, it's the topic that seems to be going so unnoticed. Even it's kind of like knowing there's a snake in your house and keep staring at the window to see how beautiful outside is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And I think the answer to your question, Annie, in the near term at least, is November 2022, the midterm congressional elections in the United States. Those have got to be an overwhelming Republican Party success, we all hope, and that would at least put something of a break on the most extreme of the Biden administration policies.
Yeah, because I guess the whole thing for me, the big thing I don't understand is I don't see any benefit at all for the United States making this deal with Iran. I mean, I think it's a terrible idea in general, but I don't understand what they would hope to gain other than just being able to say that they made a deal.
Well, here's the thing, at least in my perspective. Go back to the Obama administration, because many of the officials in the Biden administration are retreads from the earlier Obama years, right? I think that all of them come into office with a worldview that says the United States is a force for ill in the world, not a force for good. They really and truly believe that the United States of America is a force for ill in the world. And they will do anything they can to diminish us, to drag us down, to remove American influence and power from regions of the world that are critical, like the Middle East. For example, during the Obama administration, there was something called a Presidential Study Directive 11, PSD 11, which is still classified, but from leaks that have come out over the years, it is pretty much understood that that was a policy statement by the Obama administration to encourage, support, back the Muslim Brotherhood to come to power across the Middle East, especially North Africa, and yes, here in the United States too, which it did.
Yeah.
But having that as the foundation for policy in the broader Middle East and North Africa, of course, we saw the Obama administration support the Islamic uprising of 2011, which toppled Ben Ali in Tunisia and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, and took aim, at least, at Bashar al-Assad in Damascus, but didn't succeed there. But with that going to the Sunnis, okay, I think that these officials kind of thought, not only can we pull back U.S. power and influence from the region of the Middle East and leave Israel high and dry, because they loathe the Jewish state of Israel. But they also, I think, were trying to be a little bit even-handed, if you will. So North Africa goes to the Sunnis, the Muslim Brotherhood, but the heartland of the Middle East goes to the Shiites. Because if they are powerful, and Iran, of course, the largest Shiite majority country in the world, Iraq next door, the next most populous, if they can gain power, and especially if Iran can be enabled to achieve a deliverable nuclear weapon, not only would that check Israel, which, again, they hate Israel, but it would also act as a balance in their eyes against the more numerous population of Sunnis in the Middle East, in that part of the Middle East. That's my take on it. That's just, my analysis of it, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah, and from their warped point of a worldview, that does make sense. Let me ask you this. So how do you think Turkey then fits into this equation? Why would they be there to meet with both Iran and with Russia.
Oh, well, this is a really jumbled set of affairs, isn't it? So Turkey historically, you know, has been at war with the Russian Empire. It has been at war with the Persian Empire through the Caucasus with Russia and on down over into Iran. But currently, Turkey is in another tripartite, I don't know, axis arrangement, if you will, and that is Turkey together with Iran and Qatar. Now, Iran and Qatar, we understand, they've got this thing going on because they share an enormous gas field under the Persian Gulf that lies between their two countries. Got that?
Yes, yes.
Turkey aligning with Qatar and Iran is a little harder to understand, but again, it is a balancing act against Saudi Arabia in particular, and the Abraham Accords countries, GCC countries, that's Gulf Cooperation Council countries, more broadly. It's a way, again, for Turkey and Iran to oppose the U.S.-led, the U.S. aligned with Israel, now aligned with Saudi Arabia, even though it's not a formal member of the Abraham Accords, but it's certainly behind giving tacit approval. It's a way for Turkey and Iran, each with their own ambitions, with Qatar thrown in, to unify against that U.S. Western led, but in the region, Israel and Saudi led order of things in the region.
So it's kind of a way both to diminish the U.S. standing in the region and at the same time also send a message to the countries that were signers of the Abraham Accords when Trump was still in office, they expected our protection and we would have given it to them, whereas now this sort of puts them on notice. There's an alignment forming against them and they are going to be open to other attacks and probably financial repercussions as well.
It is certainly an alignment that is aimed at opposing the Abraham Accords alignment, and again, Saudis in the background, but very much part of it. Not a signatory, but very much part of that. And a way of getting at Israel, again, which this administration and the officials in it absolutely loathe.
Yeah, and we've seen that even with this last trip with the Biden regime when they were over there and you're removing the U.S. and Israeli flags from the limo and little signs like that.
Well, they removed the Israeli flag, not the U.S. one. So there was just one
flag clapping on
the car.
Oh, the pictures I saw, the U.S. one. Oh,
yeah,
see, the pictures I saw, they were both gone.
Because he was in the car. So they had to have the U.S. flag on, but they removed the Israeli one when they drove to East Jerusalem to visit that, was it a clinic, a hospital, I think?
Could be.
In a not-so-subtle dig at Israel, and not so subtle expression of tacit visual support for the Mahmoud Abbas regime in Ramallah, Palestinian Authority regime. That's what that was about.
Yeah, it's legitimizing them, and it's delegitimizing Israel's control over the region, kind of sending that backhanded message that we are not going to support.
Country. Over its own eternal and undivided capital of Jerusalem, not over the region, but over its own capital. That's what they're objecting to. That's what they're showing that they're making a statement against.
Yes, and sorry, that was a misstatement on my part. But, you're correct. It's a way of sending that message and then legitimizing them. And, you know, also while we're there, Biden reactivated their funding, which will go directly to that pay per slave program. I can never say that correctly.
Yeah. But that's right. That's exactly right. And in violation of the Taylor Force Act passed by the U.S. Congress, and also additional funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency of the United Nations, which funds quote-unquote refugees, which are now down to the, I don't know, fourth, fifth, sixth generation or whatever it is at this point, and which actively promotes through textbooks, training, summer camps, etc., Jew hatred, and literally the killing of Jews, the killing of Israelis, I should say.
Yes,
can you
yeah,
have questions
that is...
regarding these quote-unquote refugees? Isn't it interesting that after all these time, none of the Islamic countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, that is the biggest financial supporter of Hamas, has, I don't know, offered to take these people in, give them dual citizenship, anything?
Yeah. Well, two things. The one thing is that they want these so-called refugees. And by the way, the camps, again, air quotes, they're living in, they're cities. They're permanent building and structures and homes. They're not tents or anything like that. But they want that that image or that name, refugees and refugee camps, to remain as a point, as a leverage against Israel. But number two, you know, most of the Sunni neighboring countries, Jordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia for sure, Egypt, they're up to there with these people. They've had it. They're no longer interested in them. They find them troublesome. They find them annoying, and they basically want to forget about them. Honestly, they're fed up to there with them.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right that it's used as a, right now they're essentially being used as a bargaining chip. People know that as long as they have this sympathetic image that they can present, that these poor people are, you know, oppressed and without a home, and they just want a place to live safely, that it's an easy way to portray it in the media, which is a way to generate funding and revenue, and to use that as a tool to bash Israel over the head with anytime they do take actions to defend themselves after being attacked.
Yeah, you know, they try, but you know, the more the years go on, the more, as I've said, the surrounding Arab countries, these Arab states, you know, basically just want to wash their hands of these people. And as we've seen, of course, Egypt and Jordan have a long-time actual peace treaty with Israel. Now the Abraham Accords bring United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan further off, and Morocco even further off, but into the Abraham Accords, obviously, again, as we've said, with Saudi behind-the-scenes backing. Things are shifting in the Middle East. These are tectonic plates moving, and the thing is that Ramallah and the Palestinian Authority are stuck decades ago in the past, and, of course, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is in the, I forget what year, 17th? Year of a four-year term or something like that of his presidency. You know, and they haven't had elections, you know, since 2006 when, of course, Hamas won the elections. Remember that. I mean, so they're a mess. They're a mess. And nobody else wants to deal with them anymore. They're fed up with them. They're done with them. They've poured, you know, gazillions of dollars into Ramallah, which promptly siphoned off to corruption, massive corruption, and everybody knows it. The people themselves know it and resent it. So I think at this point, everybody is kind of waiting until the post Abu Mazen era, and we'll see what happens there, because of course he doesn't really have a vice president or a designated successor. But you know, things could really go to hell in a handbasket pretty quickly. Many think that Hamas would basically take over Judea and Samaria. Some people call that the West Bank. In that event, if Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority lose control of it,
so they would. You think they would move on the territory immediately? It's
well, they're already there. I mean, Hamas already has a very extensive presence in. You know how Judea and Samaria are divided up into areas A and B and C, right? One of the regions is administered completely by Israel. One of those is administered completely by the Palestinian Authority. And I think it's C area is jointly administered, right? So in the areas administered by the Palestinian Authority, Hamas would make its move. Now, the Israeli security forces are very much on the ground and have a presence because of, I mean, this is Judea and Samaria. This is the heartland of Eretz Israel.
Yes.
And so, but that could be, you know, a real mess in terms of succession in Ramallah.
Yeah. And like
feels
you said,
like
it would just take...
People...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, Michael. So it feels like the only people who are still interested in this mess, as you called it, and I call it the chaos, are literally just the Mullah regime of Iran and Biden cabal, doesn't it?
It certainly does. The thing is that none of the above, the current leaderships here in the United States or in Ramallah, or honestly at the moment in Israel, which is in a very weird betwixt and between administration periods with a caretaker prime minister right now, Yair Lapid, until elections are held once more in Israel in the fall, probably after the High Holy Days, which means October perhaps. So each of these governments, if you're talking about Ramallah, you're talking about Jerusalem, you're talking about Washington, D.C., each one is not very steady as she goes at the moment, put it that way.
Yeah, and it sounds like, from what I hear, the Benjamin Netanyahu will probably become prime minister again, that he has, I guess, a broad support would be a better way to put it, not necessarily overwhelming, but broad support.
Well, there's a lot of jockeying going on. I cannot keep up with all the different parties and potential alliances and swapping and trading that's going on.
Yeah.
But yes, Likud, the party that Benjamin Netanyahu leads, is looking to be in a strong position come the next elections, which, by the way, are the fifth elections for Israel in, I think it's 2 years.
Yes.
Insane. But yes, Bibi Netanyahu, as he's called, is and his party, Likud, is in a strong position, it looks like. But who knows, by September, October.
Yeah, and you're right, too, about the shifting alliances there. It's hard to keep track of it. Just, I think part of it's just our perspective, because we don't deal with all the minor parties or the shifting like you do in a parliamentary system. But it does make it it does muddy the waters. It's hard for us on the outside to necessarily understand why one side might switch to another or support a particular candidate.
Well, there's horse trading going on
with
different party leaderships promising different ministerial or cabinet positions to those who might jump ship from another party to theirs. That's the kind of thing that's going on right now. Alliances between parties to make a majority.
Yes, yeah.
In the Israeli parliamentary system, a coalition, it's never going to be a single party just because there are too many of them, but a coalition has to have 61 members of the Knesset in order to form a government, to be asked by the president, that's the system, to form a government. And that involves a lot of coalition building. That's what they have to do to get to that number 61. With 120 members of the Knesset, their parliament. And that's difficult to do in a parliamentary system that's so fractured.
Yes, yeah. So to kind of maybe bring this all home for our audience, what are the key things that you're watching right now? What would be like both the warning signs, if something especially bad is going to happen, or what would be warning signs that we could look for of small victories?
Well, with my eye on the clock, and I do see where we're at here in the show, but I would bring it back to Iran. And I think that the likelihood that Iran will demonstrate a deliverable nuclear capability in the very near future is a very serious possibility. I have thought for a very long time that in its clandestine program, remember, the JCPOA dealt only with the overt program, never even touched the clandestine program that has been building towards a deliverable nuclear weapons capability since the Ayatollah Khomeini gave the order to the IRGC back in 1988, before he died, essentially to get the bomb, upon which they went to Pakistan, AQ Khan, and so forth. The Iranian opposition, the NCRI, National Council of Resistance of Iran, whose member group, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, MEK, has a very strong presence inside of Iran, probably coordinating much of what is going on in terms of opposition to the regime inside that country right now, in collaboration, my view, with the Mossad. They have kept us apprised of where that Iranian nuclear weapons program is, but I've long thought, based on UN quarterly regular reporting, based on NCRI revelations backed up by satellite imagery and other intelligence, based on the document heist that Mossad carried out of Tehran back in January of 2016, based on all of those things, I have long thought that Iran's been building warheads for a while. I think it already has a handful. Again, this is just my opinion. Has a handful, fewer than 10, I would think. But at the point when Iran begins to move to mount those warheads on its missiles, which we know they have because they test them all the time,
yes,
and China and North Korea help them, when they move to mount the warheads on the missile nose cones, that will be the point of no return for Israel, because it's existential for Israel. Marg bar Israel means death to Israel, and they mean it. Israel will have to go to take steps to stop that existential threat with or without U.S. backing. That's what
I would agree. I would agree. Well, again, I'm biased, but I would agree with everything you just said as far as the Islamic regime of Iran. I would go as far as saying they do have pretty much what they need as far as equipment and weapon goes. They just don't have enough backing from neighbors to take the move. As far as the opposition, the sad news is even if MEK is helping with the opposition, that doesn't help Iran by itself, considering they are not popular within the population of Iranians. That's where I always say I wish our prince, the son of the late Shah, would actually be more involved, which, well, for now we have a problem. That's besides the point. But here's what I'm wrong.
You don't lead revolutions in Gucci loafers.
I'm sorry, say that one more time?
You don't lead revolutions, regime change, in Gucci loafers.
Exactly. Bingo. That's very true. But I guess my confusion, genuinely confusion, is why is the Israeli government, whichever one of them, which I agree, it is so confusing to even keep track. Like you wake up in the morning and government collapse. What? Okay, there's a new prime minister for now. Okay. But why is it that they are not taking the action that they have the evidence? And I've said it many times. What's the worst that can happen? 50 Islamic countries hate Israel as it is. Anti-Semitism is on the rise in Western countries anyway. What are they waiting for? Why are they really waiting
they're
for
holding
Iran
off
to attack?
They're holding off, even though they're making very detailed plans. If you've listened to the IDF chief of staff, Avi Kokavi, if you've listened to Benny Gantz, the defense minister, if you've listened even to Yair Lapid, or formerly Naftali Bennett, the prime minister that just stepped down, they are very much preparing for what must be done, an Iranian nuclear weapons attack. What's holding them back, I think, is the lack of backing from the United States. I think also because the Iranians have not crossed that final red line of mounting the warheads on the missiles. I don't think they've done that yet. It's a difficult process. And then finally, I think the Israelis are very much aware of the 150,000 or so missiles, rockets aimed at them by Hezbollah out of Lebanon, many of those now upgraded with precision guidance systems provided by Iran, and then, of course, out of Gaza, attacks from Hamas. So all of that, I think, is not holding Israel back, but letting them get ready, get fully ready. For example, they're now building out, they're now, what would I say, they're developing in its final stages the new Iron Beam defense system, which is a laser-based system, super much cheaper than the Iron Dome missile system, also much more effective. It can cover an area of the sky and take out multiple missiles at one time. It's been tested. It works, but they haven't built it out yet and put it in as many, locations as they need to yet.
Yeah, because any kind of laser-based system is going to be much less expensive to operate, and you don't have to reload it. And their targeting range on these, especially if these are chemical lasers, is far beyond what a quick-fire missile can do accurately.
Yeah, exactly. So all of that's in the mix, I think.
And I'm going to actually take advantage of your brilliant closing point, Claire, to get us to the closing of this episode. I will take it back here, what you pointed out. I want my opinion. I want my fellow Americans to listen and listen carefully. If they have to go back and listen to you again, they should do that. This all comes back to here in America, we have let the situation get to where our only ally and the only build the wall of defense between the Islamic terrorist groups, all the alphabet soup, including the Iran regime, between us and them is Israel. We have let this get to a point where we have a regime, if we call it, that could possibly not find a way to care less about us or Israel, and they could not possibly trip over themselves faster to help the terrorist Islamic movements that's coming from Middle East and it's already here in our country. That's my personal opinion, but why don't you, Claire, go ahead and give the last word of wisdom to our audience regarding here in America, what is there they need to do and they need to pay attention to when they get off this radio today?
Well, the first thing I would say very quickly is that there is absolutely no alternative, no replacement for U.S. leadership in the world and in particular in the Middle East. There is just no replacement for that. When America is strong, when America is present with influence and power, there is less chaos. I won't say none, less. When America is weak, like right now, when the entire world, friends, allies, partners, and our enemies and adversaries perceive us as weak, there is chaos. And that chaos will spiral and spiral out of control until we, America, Americans, we reassert our leadership role in the world. This is the most important thing I could say, and a lot of it does hinge on upcoming elections here in the United States at the midterms in November this year, and then in 2 years more in November of 2024 for president.
Agreed. And I think there's so much that hinges on those elections, both for Middle Eastern policy and just here at home with all the problems we're dealing with that are mounting. Well, where can people find you and follow you, and what would be the best way to support your work?
Well, I do not have a website yet, but I am posting videos and interviews like this one in a number of places. One of them would be American Truth Project. Another would be the Citizens Commission on National Security, also at the United West, at Sargis Sangari's Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. I think occasionally at Brandon House's either Worldview Weekend or Worldview Report. And then I'm on social media. I'm at Claire M. Lopez on Twitter, my name, Claire M. Lopez on Facebook. I'm at Lopez Liberty on Telegram. I sure could use some more followers there, Lopez Liberty on Telegram. And I'm at Clarecho, C-L-A-R-E-C-H-O, on Truth Social. All of your support, much appreciated, and I thank you all.
Well, I'm going to go
so much,
find your Telegram channel. I'm going to go find your Telegram channel as soon as we get off the air, and I'm going to follow you on there as well, and I'll be finding you on Twitter right after that.
Thank you very much, both of you, Annie and Michael. Very good to be with you.
Thank you, Claire. I appreciate your time, your wisdom. We will definitely have you back because everybody needs to hear what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, again, thanks for
so
making
Michael,
the time.
Before you wrap up, I'm so sorry I keep interrupting you. That is the beauty of radio, right? I just keep jumping in.
Yeah. Oh, I think I'm going to blame the system. I think there's a delay. Because I felt like I kept stepping on people's toes, but I felt like if I didn't, there was a long pause.
That's a very good point. Now, I was going to say we got literally about 2 minutes, but I want to make sure we make a couple of announcements before mm-hmm. we are out of time. So I'll start with what is very, I guess, personal to me. I want our audience to know that comes August 8th, I will be celebrating my 20th American birthday, meaning it will mark the milestone of 20 years since I stepped out of the plane and came to America. Every year by tradition, what I do is in my way of giving back to America and those who have supported me to this day, I put up a campaign and raise money for them, not me. Let's be clear. I'm not asking money for myself. On that note, this year I am dedicating this birthday gift, let's call it, to Worldview Weekend Foundation, founded by Brandon House. If you're not familiar with them, I strongly suggest you do get familiar with them. You can find the link to the campaign on liveuptofreedom.com. We're going to run it until end of August 8th, midnight. It would be greatly awesome. You could definitely make that day more special for me if you could make a contribution. What's
mm-hmm.
your announcement, Michael?
I was just going to mention that we'll have a great episode this Sunday on our other show on Let's Be Frank. We have a special guest that joined us. We had to pre-record this interview because of the situation, but that'll make a lot more sense on Sunday.
Yes, yes. Make sure to tune in this Sunday, every Sunday. Let's Be Frank, 1 hour broadcasting live on Lindell TV, Frankis Speech. You can find it on frankisbeach.com, lindelltv.com. on Frankis Beach app or Roku, and I think Apple TV. We will be on mm-hmm. air at 7 p.m. Central Time. Myself, Michael Lauber, our co-host, AJ Wilms. It's going to be a good show. We always do our best to bring you the best we can. Also, Monday through Friday, 2:30 p.m. Central Time, Live Up to Freedom on Lindell TV is my half an hour show, which sometimes when Michael is not super busy, he does join me. On that note, it's time to wrap up. Please go on liveuptofreedom.com, check out the website, sign up to our mailing list, make a contribution to Worldview Weekend Foundation to celebrate 20 years of yours truly, freedom and new life. Last words goes to you, Michael.
Yeah, and again, the Worldview Weekend Foundation is a great thing to support. They do a lot to help our community and our movement. So thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back again next Thursday. And we'll try to do it without the technical difficulties next time. How's that sound?
We're just going to try. And just so you know, Jeff Carrera will be joining us next Thursday on radio. You all stay safe, stay vigilant. God bless you, and God bless America. Goodbye, guys.
Thanks again.